This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon we have what I think is a very interesting program. You could call it a mother-daughter act, except we're not going to have them on together. They're going to talk a little bit about their relationship to each other, but basically it's two very accomplished writers. The first is Rebecca Goldstein, who's probably best known for her first novel, The Mind-Body Problem, but has also written a collection of stories, several other novels, and two very interesting philosophical works, Incompleteness, about Kurt Gödel and his Incompleteness Theorem, and Betraying Spinoza, the renegade Jew who gave us modernity. She's been a professor of philosophy at various universities, for the longest time at Barnard, also a teacher of creative writing at various universities. And these two interests, philosophy and writing, come in and out and in and out of both her nonfiction and her fiction. And in all of these books, the thing that interested me, and I didn't notice until I had read Betraying Spinoza, is that her novels and her other books, the name of Baruch or Benedict Spinoza comes up again and again. And I'd really like to know why that is. Welcome to Booktown, Professor Goldstein.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Am I wrong that you've been fascinated with Spinoza the last maybe 30 or so years?
I guess it's true. I hadn't really realized how this has been a continuous theme myself until you pointed out that it comes up in a lot of my fiction as well. And he does represent something to me, one of the major pulls in my own life toward philosophy. And there's a pull in the opposite direction that comes out in my fiction writing and also in other ways, like my mothering. And so Spinoza is one of the people that I'm constantly hearing in my head. I argue with him in my fiction. He is a very continuous voice in my head, representing to me the purest form of philosophy, somebody who made every claim for pure reason that's ever been made. And I feel those claims very strongly, and if I only felt them, I wouldn't write fiction, and I probably wouldn't be a mother either. So it's an argument I have with them.
Now, many of our listeners may know Spinoza just as a name, because I doubt very many people have read all through his Ethics and might not even know too much of his system. He was a 17th century Dutch Jew who was excommunicated by his congregation, something that happens very rarely, but didn't seem particularly perturbed by it and went on grinding lenses for a living and reasoning very rigorously for the rest of his short life. Tell us a little more about him, and particularly why your book is called Betraying Spinoza. it's not vindicating or examining, but betraying. How are you? Who is he, and how are you betraying him?
Well, difficult questions. He is. He was, as you say, a 17th century thinker, a rationalist, in the way that we mean that term in the history of philosophy. Somebody who believes that reason, the power of pure reason, the sort of faculty we use in doing mathematics, could discover the nature of the world, the sort of downplaying empirical observation. He also believed, as you indicated, his magnum opus is called The Ethics. He also believed that pure reason could actually save us. It could take the place of religion. It could ground ethics. By being true to reason, we can figure out how to be true to ourselves and good to other people. By being rational, we become good. So he takes on religion and believes that philosophy, in particular reason, can accomplish everything that religion can without the pitfalls of religion. He grew up in, as you say, in the 17th century. He experienced firsthand in many different ways the darker side of religion. He was born into a very interesting community of Jews. They were recovering their Judaism, all of them in his community, including his parents, were refugees from the Spanish-Portuguese Inquisition, which was an extraordinary calamity for the Jews, only rivaled by the 20th century calamity for Jews. And they had been forced to convert to Catholicism. They were recovering their Judaism. He was excommunicated by them when he was very young, only 23, before he had really published any of the great works for which we celebrate him now. And once he was excommunicated, he didn't convert to Christianity, although it would have been a very good career move on his part to have done so. He tried to actually live without religion. He's really, in some sense, the first secularist, the first secular humanist, someone who tries to ground morality on reason alone. And for that, he was castigated not just by his own Jewish community, but by greater Christian Europe. So he's a kind of secularist hero, and he plays an enormous role in the Enlightenment thinkers that come about 100 years later after him. As an enormous influence.
So how, in writing about him, are you betraying him?
How am I betraying him? So, in living this life of pure reason that he extols, and as I say, one which has a great appeal to me, he tells us that we really have to give up all sort of contingencies, we distance ourselves so much from our own particular situation. He's the grandest of universalists. We distance ourselves so much from the particular situation into which we've been born, our own people, our own religion, our own nationality, viewing things from this viewpoint of radical objectivity, he calls it subspecie eternitatis, from the guise of a certain form of eternity, that we almost lose touch of who we really are. It's almost a Buddhist kind of perspective that he reaches through pure reason. I look at him very personally. I look at his life. I look at what he's meant to me, to other people, in a very personal way. And it's a kind of almost love letter to Spinoza and what he represents that I don't think that he would approve of. I also look at him, again betraying his radical non-sectarianism, from a vantage point of Jewish history, where he stands in the course of Jewish history, the history that came before him, the Inquisition, his particular community, how they regarded him, how he regarded them. And I actually come around to saying that he's trying to solve one of the problems of Jewish history, the problem of fact of suffering, why this particular people has been subjected to such prejudice, to such suffering. And he comes to his radical universalism as a way of trying to solve the suffering of the Jews. This is a very sectarian way of looking at him that is is ultimately a betrayal of him, but I think for me, Mamie, after all the years that I've been teaching him as just one of the 17th century rationalists, understand him better. Understanding him from the viewpoint of Jewish history helped me actually to understand him better.
You mentioned in the book how you, in high school, or what would be the religious Jewish equivalent of high school, how you were introduced to him as somebody who had to be mentioned because he was so important, but he was such a apokoros, a heretic, that you couldn't really examine his ideas.
No, I mean, he was told to me, I first heard his name uttered as a kind of cautionary tale. I went to a very orthodox all-girls, as you say, kind of a substitute for high school, because we really, looking back, we really didn't learn all that much. But he was uttered as a kind of cautionary tale in, when we were learning Jewish history and learning about the Enlightenment, which in my school was not looked on very fondly. And he was really put forth as an example of what can go wrong if certain questions are asked that ought not be asked. And this was a kind of school that discouraged us from going on to college, even. And you know, and the worst thing that one could possibly study if one did go to college would be philosophy, which teaches you to question everything. So of course, I was hooked. And I actually used the summer vacation after I was introduced to him, and hearing how dangerous it all was, to take a course in philosophy at Columbia. So thus began my own renegade history.
The book Betraying Spinoza is part of the Jewish Encounters series brought out by Schocken Books. Did they approach you? It seems to me that you are the perfect person to write about them. Did they approach you, or did you hear about it, and did you approach them?
Well, actually, here's what happened. The editor approached me and simply said, told me about his project and said, who or what would you like to write about it? And it was meant to be a very personal kind of encounter, one Jewish thinker with either a Jewish thinker or a theme. And my whole philosophical career has been, I mean, somewhat like Spinoza's, kind of fleeing my own background and my own sectarian situation. And what I said to the editor, Jonathan Rosen, who's a wonderful writer in his own right, is, look, the only Jewish philosopher I'd be interested in writing about is Spinoza, but he is not a Jewish philosopher. There's nothing Jewish about him. He was excommunicated for good reason. There's nothing really Jewish about him, and it would be a betrayal of him to even look at him in those terms. And he said, well, gee, Rebecca, that's interesting. Why don't you write about that? And so I did, and it really turned out to me to be, as every book has to be, otherwise it won't be alive, a real process of discovery. I thought I knew Spinoza inside out. I've taught him for so many years. But looking at him in a way that is, part of me feels a betrayal and feels a violation of all that he represents and that has so influenced me. Looking at him as someone who came out of a Jewish background actually got me to see aspects of the system that I hadn't seen before, particularly that it's a long, incredibly complicated argument about identity. I mean, identity is the personal identity is the thing that he's really thinking about and trying to get us to remake. I mean, he comes up with a radical conclusion. It's radical in our own day. His, which is that to the extent that we're rational, we all of us share exactly the same identity. So it's an extreme universalist position he's coming up with. But I only actually paradoxically saw that when I looked at him from a Jewish point of view and thought of him as trying to solve this problem of what Jewish identity is and deciding that this is not a problem worth solving, that we have to become universal.
I've read several of your novels, but aside from the Spinoza book, I hadn't read any other philosophical works you've done. I don't know what sort of papers you've had published in technical journals. The other one I've read, though, is Incompleteness, The Proof and Paradox of Kurt Gödel, which again is part of a series, in this case, Great Discoveries. And again, it's a supreme rationalist that you're writing about. Was that your choice?
Yes, again it was. Again, I was approached, and this was the series on great scientific discoveries, and they wanted, you know, writers to write, not technical scientists necessarily, but really writers, so that they could put some very difficult scientific or mathematical ideas into a narrative framework and make them approachable, accessible, palatable. And so again, they asked me whom would I want to write about, and that was an obvious one to me, that it would be Gödel. He's somebody who has fascinated me my entire life. I met him once when I was a graduate student at Princeton, and he was at the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. And his, as you say, he's another supreme rationalist, somebody who believes that reason can solve the problems of what the world is and our place in it. What's so interesting about Gödel, as opposed to Spinoza, is that in his personal life, he wasn't really rational. He was in fact rather mad, and he was paranoid, and in fact his rationalist view of the world, that everything has an explanation, was shaded off, darkened into his paranoia. He ended up starving himself to death, convinced that there was a plot against him and all men of reason, and that his food was being poisoned. And so this kind of tragic situation in which brilliant thinkers are somehow undone, even by their own ideas, is one that fascinates me. It's fascinated me in my novel writing. I felt with Gödel that he's kind of character that I could almost have made up in my fiction. This is precisely the sort of character who so interests me. Somebody who's a hero in pure thought, but less than heroic in his life. Yeah. And tremendous amount of sympathy and empathy for characters of this sort for Gödel. So he's another character. Another thinker whom I not only find his ideas fascinating, but I quite love the person.
Yeah, he bears a lot of resemblances to Noam Himmel and the mind-body problem.
Yes, he does. He was a kinder man. Noam Himmel could could be rather vicious. He was bitter, and the reason for his bitterness doesn't come out until the climax of the book. But yes, there's something both heroic and really less than heroic about both Gödel and Himmel and other characters I've made up.
Yeah, I want to turn to your fiction in just a minute, but one more thing about Gödel and Spinoza. When I first encountered Spinoza 45 years ago, I had just recently read about Gödel's incompleteness theorem, his proof that there can't be a complete and consistent system of arithmetic, and the implication was that there couldn't be any complete and consistent logical system. And that prejudiced me against Spinoza when I first started reading him, but I loved his conclusion so much that I decided I didn't care if it really fit logically. But it turns out in your reading of Gödel that what he was proving was that reason could go beyond a particular system and could, in its own way, point out the flaws of a particular system, and this was a proof of the power of rationality rather than its limitations.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you put it so perfectly that Gödel showed the incompleteness of formal systems, purely mechanical systems, the kind that could be programmed into computers. But he believed that rationality and truth, but our powers of discovering truth, were broader than the purely formal, and that's why we can actually go outside of the system and see that there are true propositions which can be proved in Gödel.
And that is the sort of reasoning that people like Roger Penrose use these days to say that computers will never reach human intelligence because they can't step out of their formal algorithmic systems.
Exactly, and that we, our minds, therefore, are not computers. You know, computers aren't us, and we aren't computers. And, and that it's mathematics in particular that shows this. Penrose argues using Gödel's incompleteness. So as you say, Spinoza, which is clearly not a formal system of logic, is not really undermined by Gödel's incompleteness theorems. It's a weird system, and I don't buy the system. As you point out, what's so extraordinary about Spinoza's philosophy is that although his proofs they're very creaky, and his jargon, his terminology is medieval and creaky. I mean, part of what I try to do in The Train of Spinoza is translate it into modern terms. What's so fascinating about him is not just ethically he reaches such fundamentally brilliant insights, ones that can truly change your life, certainly change my life, but scientifically as well. He's had enormous influence. Einstein always said, when asked to, describe his own philosophical beliefs, he's a Spinozist. When asked, does he believe in God, he said, I believe in Spinoza's God. Recently, Antonio Damasio, a neurobiologist, published a bestseller in search of Spinoza, or looking for Spinoza, perhaps, in which he claims that the cutting-edge discoveries in neurobiology coming out of his lab vindicate Spinoza's views about the intertwinedness of the cognitive and the emotions. And Stephen Hawking, at the end of A Brief History of Time, that much-quoted, much-misunderstood last paragraph, when he talks about the final vindication of reason, understanding the nature of the world, he's almost verbatim quoting Spinoza there. So it's very curious that despite the strange methodology, the non-empirical methodology that Spinoza comes up with, his insights, not only in ethics, but in science, are being vindicated, these many centuries later. The man had extraordinary intuition, despite his methodology and despite his archaic terminology, that's still missed by me and so many others.
To turn now to your fiction, the novels I've read, and I've read two and a tenth of them, have to do very much with the conflict between reason and ordinary life. On the one hand, that's the mind-body problem, but then between traditional Jewishness and modern secularism in Mosul. And mind-body problem sort of shows the pitfalls of too much reason, but very comically intertwines the different ways academics approach the whole enterprise of reasoning about things. And then in Mosul, you have characters who seem to have thrown off their Jewishness only to find that it comes back on them in ways they hadn't anticipated.
Yes, all of this is true, and I suppose, what can I say here, that this is, always there's this kind of Spinozist or rationalist vision of what a life of pure reason would look like. And then there's the question of whether that consistent, rigorous life of pure reason is whether it's worth living, whether the rigorously examined life is worth living. How does it actually translate? Sometimes it really is just a flight from facing up to life. Sometimes it isn't. I don't think that that's true with Spinoza. I mean, this was a truly laudatory life that he led, and I don't think was flight from anything. But often what seems to be rational is very irrational, and from the inside it's hard to tell. And that fascinates me as a novelist. And as far as the Jewish aspect goes, I guess that's just a conflict that I've never been able to completely solve in my own mind. From a Spinoza's point of view, this ought not to matter at all what group of people you happen to be born into. But just as one's own family matters to one, that these connections of blood matter, and what and perhaps in the good life, the ethical life, they're supposed to matter, even though from the out there, specia eternitatis, they don't matter. That this is a conflict. This is one that I'm constantly trying to solve in my life and in everything I write, I suppose. So the Jewish aspect is just an example of why should these contingencies of who you happen to be, who your family happens to be, who your history, you know, what history you happen to have, why should that matter at all?
Well, you grew up...
Any sense at all.
Yeah, very. You grew up in an Orthodox family, then became very secular, but I guess your ex-husband, who is a very theoretical physicist, retained his Orthodoxy. Is that correct?
Yes, he did. And that always seemed to me incomprehensible because my ex-husband is he's a very theoretical physicist and one of the most critical minds I know, but there were certain things that he didn't question, or at least not openly. And I still, to this day, I've known him since I was 15. I still couldn't really tell you, you know, why he continues to be Orthodox. It's not something that he openly speaks about. But it's but for me, this wasn't possible. The questioning of the beliefs and my feeling that I couldn't for myself justify them meant that I had to change my life or it would be living a lie.
In your acknowledgments to several of your books, you do credit him for a lot of help and been calling him, in one case, a very tough critic. You, in one place, call your daughters Danielle and Yael very tough, and in another place you call them your kindest readers. Obviously, this has been a family matter for a long time.
Yes, they always did read everything that I wrote, and I trained them. I'm supposed to be very good critics. They are very, very good critics, very tough, but kind in the sense that the kindest thing you can do to a reader is to pay attention. I tried to write books that call for great expenditures of attention. I make great demands on my readers, and my family, my husband, my daughters have reciprocated. They do read with great attention, and this makes them very tough, but in my mind, very, very kind.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us this afternoon. I'm going to have cut off now because I'd like to go into more of the fiction, especially Mazel, which I just finished a few hours ago, and which it was so totally different from The Mind-Body Problem, which I've read twice. But this is a mother-daughter hour, and I have to hang up on you so I can call up Yael.
Well, then by all means do so, because I don't want to cut into her time, and you will find her, I think, very fascinating.
Okay, thanks very much, Rebecca Goldstein.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. We're listening to music right now called, it has two titles in the version I got, Sonia's Overture or Rhapsody in Hell, which is supposed to represent the music of Jean-Paul Boudin, the composer protagonist, one of three protagonists in A.L. Goldstein's Overture. It's her first novel that's just come out from Doubleday and bears a lot of resemblances to the work of her mother, with whom we just spoke, and also quite a few differences. Welcome to Booktown, Yael.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We talked a little bit with your mother, mostly about her work, but toward the end came up to the fact that so many of her books have acknowledgments or dedications to you, your sister, and your father, who I guess were always very close readers of her works. And in one case, she says Properties of Light began as a bedtime story. So you grew up with a mother who was a philosopher and a novelist, and I guess you started out to become a philosopher too?
Yes, I did, yeah. Sort of followed her even in her mistakes, I think. Yeah.
But you got out of it?
I did. Well, I studied it as an undergraduate, and I didn't pursue it after that. I thought about going to graduate school, but I was more enchanted by the idea of writing fiction, so I decided to give that a go for a while.
And I haven't read any of your stories, but you've published in a number of places before embarking on this first novel.
Yeah, I mean, some stories and some essays and things like that, but this is my first book, and the thing I'm most proud of, certainly.
Yeah, and it's very deftly, very fluently written.
Oh, thank you.
And a fascinating group of characters, although, as I mentioned when we talked a little earlier today, it seems to me almost like a fairy tale in that everyone is incredibly beautiful, incredibly talented, very conflicted in what to do with their talent, how to use it, but there's no question that they've all got the goods.
Yes, no question, certainly for the reader. I think in their own minds, there's some question, but certainly from the reader's point of view, they're all incredibly blessed human beings.
And the narrator is Natasha Darsky, who, it says on the jacket, the most famous violinist since Paganini,
right,
who had developed discovered that she could be taught herself, essentially, violin, then had other teachers who went on and improved it, but took a side turn into composing, then fell in love with a brilliant but very iconoclastic composer, Jean-Paul Boudin. They became lovers, and at a certain point, she decided that she couldn't compete with him. She couldn't live in the same world with him as a composer. So she left him, and this gave even more power to her performance. He seemed to disappear, but what had happened between the two of them radically affected his composition, and many years later, her daughter falls under his sway.
Yeah.
None of them know quite which way to go, and they all change directions a couple of times.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
Did you think of them at all in any way as symbols or just as people with real conflicts and complicated interactions?
Yeah, no, I thought of them as real people, certainly. I mean, it is true. They, you know, Jean-Paul, maybe more than anyone else, is sort of very much of a type, you know, this sort of, as you said, this iconoclast, someone who's almost obsessed with his own iconoclasm. You know, he's a monomaniac, just driven by his work. Also, you know, so in that sense, you know, he's like this paradigm figure, but he's also this incredibly loving man. Towards the end of the book, or even actually gets towards the middle, you realize that, you know, God, as much as he seems obsessed, he thinks, you know, he would have given it all up to have stayed in this relationship with Tasha, whom he had loved so much. So, you know, I do think of them as sort of more complicated than they would be if they were just pure symbols. They were friends for a while, certainly.
There was a character in your mother's book, Mazel, Yasha Saunders, who's very similar to Jean-Paul Boudin, except he doesn't live long enough to to undergo all the conflicts.
Huh, that's interesting. Yeah, there is something similar there, this sort of larger-than-life personality in a similar way.
And also the fact that they both sort of despise pretty melodies, and they are very rigorous musicians. They want the music to be as totally formally perfect as possible and have no concern for either the what emotions it might represent for them or what it might bring out in their listeners.
Yeah, I mean, Jean-Paul is actually, he does have a concern for what emotion it might bring out in his listeners, insofar as he doesn't want any emotion brought out in his listeners. He thinks that this is a terrible mistake, that people pay attention to the emotions that music evokes in them rather than paying attention to the pure formal perfection of the notes themselves, the connections between the notes and things like that. He's it's even more than indifference. It's outright hostility. Although that of course changes later in his life. That's sort of his youthful version or vision for his music. And as he matures, he does realize that, you know, music first and foremost has to be beautiful, and he's able to bring his ideas to fruition more fully by paying a little less attention to the ideology and a little more attention to the beauty and where the music wants to go itself.
That's interesting. I had the feeling, reading the book, that it wasn't so much he came to this conclusion as that the emotions aroused in him by Tasha's leaving were so intense that the music he wrote under that duress just had to have a strong emotional content. It had to touch people.
Yeah, that's a much better way of putting it. Much more accurate, yes.
Now, was he also, since we're sort of doing mother-daughter hour today, he bears some resemblance to Noam Himmel in your mother's first novel in a totally different sphere, in that Himmel is a person who has no time or space for anything that does not follow, that's not really systematic and rigorous.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, it's funny you should mention that, actually, because when I first had the idea for the book, I thought I was either going to make all the characters mathematicians or I was going to make them musicians. And I thought, well, my mother's already done the mathematicians, so I'm going to go with musicians. He could have seemed even more similar to Noam Himmel if I had gone the first route. I think he does, you know, that obsession is similar. A certain way of treating human beings, I think, is a little similar in that he doesn't, I think both of them don't realize that their significant others are not as wrapped up in their obsession as they would like them to be, or as they themselves are wrapped up in their obsession. And then they don't realize that there's an alienating aspect to this. They think that they're bringing this great gift into the woman's life. And I think Jean-Paul is less guilty of this than Noam Himmel is. He's sort of more aware of others around him, certainly, you know, very, very romantically in love with Tasha. But there is that similar element of being so wrapped up that you don't realize you're insensitive to the people you're with.
What gives Overture a different depth, or I wouldn't say greater depth, but a different, an added dimension that, say, the mind-body problem doesn't have, is the fact, though, that it spans the generations, and that after leaving Jean-Paul, Tasha has a daughter in a essentially casual encounter, just about the only casual encounter she's ever had.
Yep.
And that daughter grows up to be, at one point, her partner, and then for a while her greatest antagonist.
Yeah.
Again, because she is struggling to free herself from her mother's dominance.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing, of course, is that the way she finally does free herself, and she had been a piano prodigy and had accompanied her mother in many concerts, then at a certain point turned to composition and eventually fell under the influence of Jean-Paul Boulmédien. And that's what gave her her own, in the end, I hope I'm not giving away too much, that's what gives her her own voice in the end.
Yeah.
And I don't think I am giving away too much, because on the very first page where Tasha is talking to a reporter, she says really that, well, her daughter is listening from the other room, and she mentions Jean-Paul as being the greatest influencer in her life, and you know that when the daughter storms out, there's something very complex going on.
Yeah, right.
And the pleasure of the novel is not the suspense. You know, how at one point there's a suspicion that maybe Jean-Paul and Alex, the daughter, have also been lovers.
Right.
But they weren't, and it's not really that important.
No, no.
Do you feel a sort of similarity with Alex?
No, not at all, actually. Okay. The part of the book where there is this real antagonism between the mother and daughter was extremely difficult for me to write because my mother and I have the most boringly, disgustingly good relationship. We never had conflict. I think maybe for 1 month when I was 12 years old, we had a stormy period. And other than that, I don't think we've had a fight since then. We just always get along. It's always perfect. So I had to do a little field research for that one. I mean, you know, obviously I've spoken to friends over the years who have had conflict with their mother. And my sister had a little bit of a stormier relationship with my mother. So a lot of that, those sort of really difficult scenes between the mother and daughter were drawn from things that I observed between my mother and sister.
And I hear you do a great deal of research. You've never been to Poland, but some of the most interesting scenes are set in Krakow and its environs.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think it's actually easier for me to write about a place that I don't know just because, you know, I know what it takes to make it rich and real on the page. I have to evoke it for myself as well.
Yeah, I was actually going to say that I thought actually the evocations of New York and Cambridge seemed rather thin to me.
Uh-huh.
But Krakow, I've never been there, but it makes me want to go.
Yeah.
You said when you started writing this, you didn't know whether to make them mathematicians or musicians. So you had the basic conflict already worked out?
Well, I knew that I wanted, what I started out with as an idea was that I wanted it to be about someone who takes her work enormously seriously and is sort of obsessed with it and is willing to sort of sacrifice her own happiness for it, but is not sure whether she wants to cannot sacrifice or is not willing to, or at least has this conflict about sacrificing, you know, the happiness of those who depend on her to this art form. Or to whatever the work is. And it seemed to me that it had to be some sort of field of work, first of all, that invites incredible obsession. Second of all, I wanted it to be a field where at least the popular perception is, or the perception within the field, is that you've either got it or you don't. There are the great people and then there's everyone else. And I think math and music are the most like this and also lend themselves to the most obsessive personalities.
And is that something you plan to write about obsessive personalities?
Yes, yeah, that's something I plan to write about, yeah.
In what's coming up then?
Oh, you mean...
Yeah, do you have another novel in the works or stories?
I do. No real obsessive personalities in that one. That one's a lot more mellow in that one, I would say.
And how long? What sort of process do you go through to come up with something like this?
To come up with the idea or to
work out the novels. I'm just interested because I know your mother's works cover quite a wide range, but the basic themes are fairly similar.
Yeah.
But the actual working out very different. And I guess I'm curious, you started to say you were going to continue to deal with obsessive people, and then you said, no, in this book you're not.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I wondered, is it something where you come up with, are your books more character-driven, theme-driven, plot-driven?
I would say that they're largely character-driven. I think my first idea for a book, at least, I mean, I've only had two ideas that I've worked on for books, the Overture and the one I'm writing now, but my first idea in both cases was sort of thematically driven, but immediately, the sort of thing that draws my interest is the characters, and the characters take over, and wherever they want to lead, that's where the book will go, theme be damned.
So you didn't necessarily know how Overture was going to end?
I had no idea how Overture was going to end. In fact, it ended several different ways before I finally settled on one.
It seems quite satisfactory, though, because in each case you have one of the characters, especially mother and daughter, struggling about how to free themselves from another person's artistic dominance.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I knew that that was going to be, that the struggle to free oneself from the artistic dominance, that was going to all, you know, that was always going to be sort of driving the plot. or driving the characters, but how exactly that freeing from dominance was going to happen and how successful it would be, all of that I was really, really unsure of for a long time.
And the book you're working on now, when do you expect it to be done?
I'm hoping to be finished with it by the end of next year.
Do you run your books by your mother the way she did by you and your sister?
Oh, yes, very much so. I would be lost without her, I think. Just knowing that I could show her a draft makes it so much easier to write the draft, and knowing that there'll be this fantastic yet kind criticism at the end of it. I think I probably show her more. Certainly I show her more drafts, or she's more involved with my drafts than I ever was with any of her novels, just because I was younger the last time she finished a novel. Maybe I was as involved with the Girdle and Spinoza books as she was with my novel. There's a little bit more of a draw.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for talking with us, Yael Goldstein, and good luck on your future works.
Okay, thank you so much. Wonderful to talk to you as well.
Thanks. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'm not going to be here in 2 weeks. We have a membership drive coming up from the 14th to the 20th of May, and this program is going to be preempted for that. However, there are a number of things going on, and I'd like to let listeners know some other ways they can interact with this program if they like. For the past couple of years, I've been archiving recordings of Booktown programs, and there's over 50 of them online right now. You can reach these by going to kvmr.org and just clicking on Finding Booktown, go to the program schedule, and then go to Booktown, and if you click on that, it'll take you to the weblog that contains all of this material. And you can do the same thing with the program that normally would be on the 14th of May. On that program, there's going to be two parts. I'm first going to be talking with mystery writers Marcia Mueller and Bill Pronzini. They've both been writing mysteries for 20 to 30 years, mostly in Northern California. They each have some books that take place partly or completely in Nevada County, and I'll be talking with them on that. They are coming to the Madeline Helling Library on Friday, the 18th of May, and this will be a bit of a preview. I expect parts of the interview will be on the KVMR Evening News, probably the evening of the 16th, Wednesday the 16th. But if you want to hear the complete interview, you can go to kvmr.org and go to the Booktown, where Booktown is underlined on the program schedule, that will link you to the Booktown blog, or you can also go directly to booktown.blogspot.com. And as I said, that will get you any of the 50-some programs that have been recorded over the past couple of years. So I'll be back on the, and in the second half of the program, I expect to be talking with a number of local people about the late Kurt Vonnegut, and we will be sharing our thoughts about him. I'm going to read a few of his short pieces. That'll be the second half of that program that will not be on the air on Monday the 14th. I'll be back on the 28th with editors from Counterpunch online political newsletter and from the Monthly Review. This has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.